This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello and welcome to The Country Hour this Tuesday. I'm Isabella Pittaway. Now, if you're in a border community, how have you found the new travel restrictions, particularly having to get a COVID test every 7 days? Send me a text on 0467 922 891. I'd love to hear from you. The owners of a southwest Victorian spray contracting business say they may have to close their doors because of the effects of South Australia's tight border restrictions.
If he's got to line up like that every week for that amount of time, it actually won't be feasible. We're better to pull the plug on the business now before we go backwards. So that's the decision we've had to make.
Also this lunchtime, the $10 million mission to keep food on our plates, how the government, agribusinesses and researchers are hoping to use data to make our food supply chain more resilient. And there's certainly been a lot testing it this year between COVID, drought, bushfires and the trade war with China. I'll bring you more on that story after the weather. But first today, the lack of mobile reception was a common issue for areas affected by bushfires last summer. So much so that in Mick Kelty's bushfire review, he recommended information and communications technology be upgraded. So what's being done to better prepare communications in rural and remote areas before the next bushfire season? Bridget Herman reports.
Last summer, a bushfire burnt through 37,000 hectares in the farming community of Kalaira in southeast South Australia. The region has patchy mobile reception at best, and communicating during the fire was an issue. Now the local council is providing Kalaira residents, many of whom are also local firefighters, with UHF radios. Kingston District Council CEO Nat Traeger explains how they're being delivered.
So anyone who wanted one, let us know what they needed, and we had a database of what had been donated so they could pick through that. But the whole point is to have some updated and consistent radios so that they can better communicate.
Kalaira is also in the process of receiving a base station to supply mobile coverage across the region. But Ms. Traeger believes the radios will still be useful.
You've got to pick up the phone and dial a number, at least on a UHF radio. If you're all on the same channel, you don't have to make 5 phone calls or 10 phone calls. You can hear each other. Realistically, that is not going to be delivered, you know, within probably another 18 months.
Just like Kalaira, South Australia's Kangaroo Island suffered from severe bushfires over summer. More than 200,000 hectares were burnt. Also like Kalaira, mobile coverage in the region can be patchy. Kangaroo Island Mayor Michael Pengilly says the fire did pose communication challenges.
Mobile services were an issue, the CFS radios were an issue, UHF radios were another issue. Fires, terribly hard to manage communications and things get out of skew very quickly. So we just have to keep working at it. I don't know if there's any perfect answer to it.
But he says the council's not looking at UHF radios as an option.
Residents want good mobile coverage. They don't ask for a lot in regard to communications, but even out on the west end of the island on the north coast, you can't get ABC Adelaide out there. You can occasionally pick up Port Pirie, but not always 891 in Adelaide. So it's a double-edged sword.
He says there were points during the fire where emergency radio wasn't available.
People were told to rely on listening to the emergency radio being ABC, and a lot of the time they can't get it. So we need other systems. We need phone towers that are working so people can communicate, or radio systems that will work so when these dreadful situations arise, they can find out what's going on and can communicate.
Back in mainland South Australia, the Adelaide Hills had the 23,000-hectare Cuddly Creek bushfire. David Waters directed the fire recovery at the Adelaide Hills Council. He says that black spots were an issue following the fire.
We had feedback from our community in the days following the fire that a number of them were disconnected from telecommunications for a number of days due to power outages where there were mobile phone towers, but also in areas where mobile phone coverage was patchy, that made things even more difficult for people, including our own crews when we were out and about in the area. We're asking for the federal government to step in and focus its mobile phone black spot program on areas of high bushfire risk, including, of course, the Adelaide Hills. We have a number of townships in our area that are existing black spots, including Cuddly Creek, which was the ignition point for our fire last December.
Mr. Waters says they're also asking for the federal government and telecommunications operators, or telcos, to work together to create more resilient towers with longer backup batteries. He says the current batteries last for only 4 hours, which isn't long enough during a bushfire.
Power's often cut off for over a day in the event of a bushfire, sometimes several days, and people need to be able to get mobile telecommunications back on track. It's important not only for making phone calls, but people rely on the data to get information about what's going on.
He says the council has been petitioning for more mobile base stations.
So it has been something we've been asking for a number of years, particularly over the last 4 or 5 years.
So what's the Australian government doing? It's currently in the fifth round of funding for mobile communications infrastructure under the Mobile Blackspot Program. Minister for Regional Communications, Mark Colton, says round 5 and 5A are prioritising regional and remote areas.
To fund innovative models of service delivery, we're looking at funding bushfire-affected areas and routes along major transport routes.
But one limitation with that approach is that a telco might not choose to service a black spot area that also has a low population. In round 5A, third parties such as councils and community groups can put forward an application for a tower.
We want to make sure that we now have a model that, come up with a model that will go into those harder to reach areas. And the telcos have decided that the model doesn't suit them, and we need to make sure that we keep reaching out to regional Australia. And we're open for applications, so we are open to offers from whoever can come up.
Minister Colton says on average, base stations can take 12 months to become operational. Any constructed in round 5A would likely not be working for the upcoming bushfire season. But the funding has also secured temporary portable base stations, which can be put up in the wake of a fire and run off of a generator. There's also $37 million of federal government money going into bushfire-hit areas. That money's looking at funding longer-lasting base station batteries, reliable electricity connections, and satellite communications.
To say that we can have this problem rectified by the next summer is unrealistic. We recognise that we've got a problem and we're working as quickly as we can.
That was the Federal Minister for Regional Communications, Mark Colton, finishing that report from Bridget Herman.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
It is coming up to 13 past 12. My name's Isabella Pittaway. Well, there's certainly been a lot of disruption across the border in Victoria with its abattoirs. And analysts say that abattoirs in Victoria should be able to cope, though, with a cut to 2/3 of capacity. The Victorian government has confirmed that abattoirs will have to reduce their operations and that workers inside the plants will have to wear as much protective equipment as healthcare workers. Nikolai Bailhart spoke with Matt Dalgleish from Thomas Elder Markets, who says there's now a bit more clarity in what a cut to capacity actually means.
So when it came out, the wording was just that it was 33% below peak capacity. The initial understanding of that was that that would be looking at the actual production side. So what, and we looked at it at Thomas Elder Markets at the number of head that's been processed within Victoria abattoirs per week. Looked at the numbers on that. So that's what we're working off. Subsequently, the clarification is that it's to do with the peak capacity of the workforce, which is obviously a bit harder to get the data on workforce stats and a bit more. There's different obviously workforce numbers and different elements depending upon the abattoir. But, we as a proxy probably will still keep focusing on those livestock numbers just because that's what's available and that gives us a good idea of what's happening in the industry as it stands now.
And I guess too does give you, there has to be some certain link between, well, if you're cutting workforce numbers, production's going to drop as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we know that when, you know, previous to COVID epidemics, when you've had, you know, like through winter when we are now, and you do get abattoirs and meatworks that will reduce shifts or shut down depending upon circumstances, you know, through Easter, through holiday period, they often will shut down or do a bit of maintenance, so they reduce. And you see a drop in, obviously, workforce hours, but you'd probably, and that corresponds to a drop in how many head they're processing.
And so looking at that number of head that have been run through, at least for cattle and for sheep and lambs, I gather the broad overview is the reduction in capacity should be okay?
Well, that's a curious thing. I mean, we looked at the numbers for the last 5 years in terms of weekly peaks in Victoria. And if you look at lamb, because we're already in tight supply for lamb and sheep and also for cattle through this just because of the season, this year we've actually seen, if you look at the average weekly slaughter for lamb, we're already 32% below peak production, you know, if you look at what the highest one was in the last 5 years. For sheep, it's even bigger. We're about 63% below the peak production, I guess, you know, from a number of head processed. You know, looking back the last 5 years, and for cattle, we're similar to lamb. We're down about 32% for Victoria in terms of, you know, when you look at and see what the peak's been in the last 5 years. So from that perspective, at least for cattle and sheep abattoirs, some of them would already be operating at a lower capacity as it stands right now. So it's going to be a curious one to see, you know, are they looking at that, you know, say the last 5 years peak, or are they looking at the peak from this year? That's the only other uncertainty.
And kind of in a roundabout way, and I know this is looking at things glass half full, but in a sense it's almost a good year for this to happen rather than a year when everything's going gangbusters.
That's right, yeah. If you go back to, you know, when we had significant turnoff and big numbers going through abattoirs and they were operating at peak and producers were turning off livestock, you know, potentially because of drought scenarios and didn't have an option to feed, you know, at least you know, for the producer, for cattle and sheep and lamb producers, they're able to. It's not ideal scenario, don't get me wrong. It's not a great thing if you're wanting to turn off. But if you've got, you know, it's a good season, it's in winter, which, you know, the turnoff's already low in winter anyway, seasonally. But, you know, there's a lot of places out there with pasture, you know, so you can actually hold on and not have too much of a drama in terms of disrupting your scenario for cattle and sheep and lamb. The bigger concern from my perspective would be intensive farming like your chicken farms and your pig farms that actually don't really have that seasonal movement that we're seeing through winter for the other animals. You know, they turn off pretty regularly, you know, every week. And, you know, if this is obviously going to impact those abattoirs that are processing pork and chicken, hopefully there's a resolution there, or they're able to send some of those animals into state to be processed, because there's going to be a heck of a backlog of chicken and pork if we can't produce, you know, go through and process them at the rates that they're getting turned off each week.
That's Matt Dalgleish, the manager of Commodity Market Insights at Thomas Elder Markets. And soon you'll hear from Darren Thomas from Thomas Foods International about how South Australia's meat processing is going. But staying with COVID news, and the owners of a far southwest Victorian spray contracting business say they're considering shutting up shop because of South Australia's border closure. Now, to get permission to cross the border, Nelson residents Sue and Mark Harrison must get a COVID-19 test every 7 days. And Sue says that so far, that's been a time-consuming and stressful process.
Well, we had to get it done in Mount Gambier. Mark actually went in first because he had to get going with his business. And the first day he was there between 3.5 and 4 hours, and he actually got sent away because the hospital was at its capacity.
So he was turned away that first day, and then he had to come back again the next day?
Yeah, so he was the next day, still didn't get tested till lunchtime, so he was there first thing in the morning when it opened. So we really lost 2 full days of work, which, because it's seasonal, it's really important that we work when the work's there as well as the weather's right. It really is very stressful this time of the year for him now, without any stress added on to him. So we actually did consider, do we close the business? Yeah.
Right, so that's how big these impacts are, so that you're wondering whether it's feasible for you to carry on.
Yeah, if he's got a line up like that every week for that amount of time, it actually won't be feasible. We're better to pull the plug on the business now before we go backwards. So that's the decision we've had to make. We think we can get around it to a degree because we have children in Mount Gambier. So how we're going to try to get around it is if it's good spraying days for the week, he'll stay at my son's until there's a morning or afternoon where the weather's terrible, and then he'll line up and get tested because we haven't actually got an alternative.
Okay, so you'll probably end up being separated.
Oh, we will. That's without a doubt. And not only this, we're actually choosing not to go into populated areas in South Australia as a choice, as, you know, like being very aware that we don't want to pass anything on to anyone, not that we think we have it. So we're actually being made to go into Mount Gambier once a week when we normally would not.
And just on that point, Sue, I imagine your husband being a spray contractor, going about his work, really not coming into contact with many people at all?
No, he'd probably see one person a day that he would have to talk to face-to-face. If that, he would be one of the safest people in Australia.
Right, so this requirement, Sue, this requirement to get a COVID test every 7 days, for you, it sounds like it's just not practical. It's just not working for you in running your business.
No, it won't. It just won't. No, we can't do it. I don't understand. It doesn't make sense to me. It's a worry that this is how the country's thinking. I don't think they're thinking logically as far as, they're not realising how country areas work.
So what do you think should happen?
I think that people at the core need to think about when they make decisions, what it's actually affecting as far as the Premier's made a decision in Adelaide. And I don't think, is my opinion, he's got any idea on how country areas work. I don't think he's thinking logically as far as what is the risk that we give to the South Australian community. It's very low. We're very, very careful in our town not to mix with anyone from anywhere else from Victoria because we don't want to pass it on. And we're the people that feed the community, and big dairy farms rely on Mark, and we're not talking of thousands of dollars, we're talking of hundreds of thousands of dollars will be lost if our business closes.
That was Sue Carrison from Nelson, just over the border in far southwest Victoria, speaking to Angus Verley about some of the problems that these new requirements to have a COVID-19 test every 7 days is causing. You are listening to The Country Hour. My name's Isabella Pittaway and it's 22 past 12. Now, if you checked your bank account one day and noticed that a few hundred or a few thousand dollars were missing, you'd probably make several frenzied phone calls, one of those to the police. But when it comes to livestock that might go missing or are suspected to be stolen, graziers aren't the best at reporting it to police. In the last 4 years, police estimate about $36 million worth of stock has been stolen in New South Wales, and they hope to catch more offenders with the launch of Operation Stock Check. Detective Inspector Cameron Whiteside is the New South Wales Rural Crime Coordinator, and he told Amelia Bernasconi that all officers are now equipped with the knowledge to drive down stock theft and catch offenders.
This operation, and it's an ongoing operation, not a flash in the pan operation. It's directly aimed at preventing stock theft. So we encourage all farmers and all livestock carriers to get their travelling stock statements in order, make sure that they're filled out correctly and they match the stock they have on board. Because what's going to happen, and it's already started to roll out now across the state, is we're increasing the capability of our police and their knowledge in terms of pulling over these stock vehicles. And that's just not the rural crime investigators, that's the uniformed police in the smallest sectors from Tenorfield right down to Blaney, from Eugowra out to Ivanhoe, so in all areas in between. This operation is aimed squarely at criminals. It's not a revenue-raising exercise. It's not to target truck drivers or those that carry livestock genuinely. It's for those that prey upon our farmers on day and night and steal those valuable stock.
And you've only just launched it, but already having some great success.
Yeah, there's been a recent arrest in relation to a 27-year-old Ningen man in respect to a stock theft and animal cruelty offences and a number of other offences.
you know, once the stock's taken, obviously that's when your guys can jump into action. But what sort of preventative measures would you be encouraging farmers to take on farm?
Yeah, we quite often get asked this question. It's all about target hardening your property. And a good place to start is to step outside your property and think like a criminal for 5 minutes and just say, well, if I was to break in here or come in and steal something here, when would I do it? How would I go about it? And that just starts to give you a way to approach tightening up the security of your property. The Rural Crime Prevention Team and the police will never tell you how to run your farm, but what we can advise you is how to tighten things up. And that's just about regular accounting for your stock. And it's not easy at times, especially in broadacre farming, is to do regular stock takes. Make sure that your equipment is out of sight and secured the best that you possibly can. CCTV is quite accessible these days, and trail cameras. But another good thing to do is just know your neighbours. Rely on your neighbours and, have the trust in your neighbours and build up that local neighbourhood network where you know when things are out of place. The biggest thing you can do is report things in a timely manner.
That's Detective Inspector Cameron Whiteside, the State Rural Crime Coordinator. It is 25 past 12. Standing by at the Weather Bureau, it's good afternoon to Senior Forecaster Tom Bowick. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Isabel.
Well, Victoria's got snow and we're waiting for some rain. What's happening today?
Yes, certainly is a fair bit going on for today and, well, particularly for the days to come. At the moment, the weather pattern, we have this high-pressure ridge over the state at this point in time, but there is a low-pressure system going to be developing near the western border. So there was a little bit of rainfall overnight and some weak showers sort of pushed up from the south. We had sort of 1 to 5 millimetres about the southern coast and the lower southeast parts of the Thurio Peninsula, generally less than 1 millimetre for the southern agricultural area. Now, the rest of the today, we just have a slight to medium chance of some showers still for the lower southeast district. There is some weather developing in the far west of the state associated with that low pressure system, some possible thunderstorms and maybe some raised dust for western parts of the northwest pastoral district. As we move into Wednesday, it looks like a very cold morning coming up for central and eastern districts with some sort of fairly light winds in those areas. There'll be areas of frost, likely to be some frost warnings out for tomorrow morning as well. Now, as the low moves in from the west slowly, there'll be a very high chance of showers extending from the west for areas to the northwest of about Elliston to Maree, and a slight to medium chance of some showers for remaining parts to the northwest of about Port Lincoln to Yunta. Those showers may tend to rain in the far north later. Some possible thunderstorms also possible to the northwest of Woomera there, and maybe some raised dust for the northwest pastoral as well. Now, moving into Thursday, a cold morning for central and eastern districts with some frost patches, not as many around us for Wednesday morning. Showers will be sort of tending to increase as well, so a slight to medium chance of showers for the southern agricultural area, but increasing to a high to very high chance of showers or even areas of rain in the north or to the north. Some possible thunderstorms north of Woomera. Looks like being very cold during the day, so we've got some unusually cold to very cold conditions coming through the state during the day. Maximum temperatures look like being well below 10 degrees if you're in the higher ground of the state. There's even a slight chance of some light snow for the higher ground of the Mid-North and Flinders Ranges districts for later on Thursday. Friday will be a similar day. Areas of rain and possible thunderstorms in the east, but they'll be contracting eastwards. Medium to high chance of showers for the remainder of the agricultural area in the southern pastoral districts. Once again, it'll still be unusually cold to very cold conditions during the day with those maximum temperatures well below 10 degrees for the high ground on Friday and still a slight chance of some snow for the high ground of the Mid-North and the Flinders Ranges districts.
Chance of snow?
Yes, there is a chance there for Thursday and Friday, but only for those higher ground areas for the, as I said, for the Flinders and the Mid-North there. Would only be a very light dusting, if anything. For Saturday, high to very high chance of showers for the agricultural area, just a slight to medium chance for the south of the pastoral districts. Just to finish off, the cumulative rainfall totals, importantly, until midnight on Saturday, expected to be 15 to 25 millimetres for areas to the north of about Cummins to Loxton, but southeast of Nullarbor to Marla, so not in the far northwest, and also for the Mount Lefeu Ranges. There'll be some isolated falls in those areas of 25 to 50 millimetres, Elsewhere, rainfall 5 to 15 millimetres, but less than 5 millimetres if you're in the lower southeast there, Isabella.
Thanks very much, Tom. Briefly, for the far west of New South Wales, the Upper Western District expecting a sunny day with temperatures between 15 and 20. And for the Lower Western District, a sunny day after some morning frost, going for a top of 14 degrees.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Isabella Pittaway. Isabella Pittaway.
Hello, hope you're well this Tuesday. Between bushfires, trade wars, drought and COVID-19, there's been plenty of disruption to our food supply chains this year. And now government and businesses are spending money to make those supply chains stronger. If you're part of the food supply chain, whether you're a producer, a cafe owner, a picker or a packer, how has COVID-19 affected the way that you do business? Send me a text on 0467922891. And as a consumer, how has it changed the way you shop? 0467922891. Plus, we know the drought has been tough on farmers, and it's also been difficult for our endangered species. Arid Recovery has lost 95% of its endangered bittong population, and that's not the only animal in trouble.
The species that's most at risk at the moment is the greater sticknest rat. We went from around 60 active nests with at least two animals in each of them a couple of years ago down to four.
You'll hear how that conservation park is adapting to the ongoing drought a little later on. Right now, though, with the latest in news headlines, it's good afternoon to Wendy Glamachak.
Good afternoon, Isabella. In the news this hour, South Australia has confirmed two new cases of coronavirus, taking the number of active cases in the state to 10. Both new cases involve women in their 20s. One's been linked to a cluster involving two Adelaide schools. Health authorities believe the woman visited several places in the last week while she was infectious, including Jaffe Carpet Gallery in Kilburn, Aga Juice House in Blair Athol, and Fernwood Fitness in Salisbury Downs. Separately, anyone who went to the Walker's Arms Hotel in Walkerville on Monday, Tuesday or Wednesday of last week are also being told that if they develop symptoms, they should immediately self-isolate and get tested. Meanwhile, in Victoria, tough new fines will apply for anyone found repeatedly breaching isolation rules, as that state records another 439 new cases of COVID-19. And doctors from the Women's and Children's Hospital have posted a video online to highlight what they say is a critical lack of resources at the hospital. More than 200 doctors sent a letter to the hospital's chief executive last October, pleading for more resources and staff, but they say they've been ignored. We'll bring you more ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Wendy. Well, we're going to stay talking about COVID-19 because as part of Victoria's response to the COVID-19 crisis, abattoirs will move to two-thirds production from midnight Friday, and workers will have to be dressed in full PPE. That's including gowns and face shields as if they're health workers. So given those changes, could South Australia be called upon to lend a processing hand? Darren Thomas is the CEO of Thomas Foods International. Good afternoon, Darren. Good afternoon, Darren.
Hi.
Oh, hello. Hi, Darren, we've got you there.
We've got you there.
Now, first of all, what do you make of what's happening in Victoria?
Look, it's you know, it's a very concerning situation. I think you know, we've all had a lot of exposure to this in terms of what's been happening there in Victoria, and it's certainly, you know, we feel for all of our fellow Victorians and Australians over there. It's an incredibly difficult situation they're in, and not just in industry, but just the general population there, what they're having to go through. So, yeah, look, it's not ideal, and I guess I've been personally experiencing this throughout the world at our various plants and operations, and we're seeing a lot of similarities. So, you know, fingers crossed that that we can get ahead of this, and I'm sure we will if we keep following the advice of the professionals.
What could this mean for your business here in South Australia? Would you be able to help out?
Well, look, certainly, I mean, I'm very confident the Victorian processes will be able to manage this. Now, we've seen in a number of cases where there have been outbreaks in various food production facilities, and that is not uncommon what we've seen around the world. I think one thing about the food processing industry, and particularly the export certified companies, is that they're very used to strict hygiene standards. And I think what's been laid out clearly is a set of protocols that they need to adopt that are further enhanced. And I've got every confidence that if they do that, they'll be able to manage it. Now, this is a very insidious virus. It seems to be very transmissible. So they have a plan, but I guess should things continue to deteriorate there, certainly I'm sure not only just our company, but many of the processors in other states will be there to assist the food production supply chain.
Has anyone from Victoria been in touch with you?
Look, we have a business there, just recently acquired Fru International, now Fru Foods, and we've certainly got a plan there should they have a positive case or be shut down in any way. So we've got our plants here in South Australia and New South Wales. And, you know, in recent times when there's been some Victorian processes, Midfield had well, they actually didn't have a positive case, but they took the very proactive case of shutting their plant for a couple of days to make sure all their employees were safe, and we helped process some of their stock. So within the processing community, I'm sure there's going to be people help out. This is not a time to play, you know, competitors. It's a national problem, and I'm sure most processors like ourselves will be here to help out if required.
I'm speaking to Darren Thomas, who is the CEO of Thomas Foods International, and we're speaking about some of these changes that will be made in Victoria to abattoirs. They'll move to two-thirds production from midnight Friday, and workers will have to be dressed in full PPE as if they were working as a health worker. Now, Darren, I don't want to start a panic buying spree, but should South Australian consumers be concerned about a meat shortage?
No, look, even going back some months ago, I spoke about this publicly. We've got a very robust supply chain here in Australia and South Australia, and I certainly wouldn't, I can't foresee any major disruption at this stage. I mean, if the whole entire country was to be engulfed in the pandemic and food processing supply chains were breaking down, there could be some reason for mild concern. But again, my experience in seeing what's happened in the US, and they certainly did have a lot more trouble than us within their food supply chains. They managed through it, and I'd be quite confident here in Australia. You know, sometimes the sparseness of Australia is an asset to us as well. So, but there is no need for concern or anything, particularly here in South Australia. I think, you know, the South Australian community is doing a good job at trying to manage this. We've got to be aware. You can see there's, you know, a couple more cases today, so we need to remain vigilant. But I certainly wouldn't be panic buying at this stage.
You mentioned before, Darren, about your overseas business, and we're going to be talking soon about some of the disruption that there has been to the food supply chain this year. How have your overseas businesses been affected, particularly, as you mentioned, in the US?
Yeah, look, they were in areas, and particularly in the northeast of the country, New Jersey, New York State, which were very hard hit early on. Again, they went to hard lockdowns over there. So there was whilst the supermarkets remained open, there was a huge surge in panic buying. There was some disruption to their meat works there in terms of beef. So we ended up having to work 7 days. Two shifts. We saw a massive surge in our online business, as we have seen here in Australia. And basically, the most important things always and first is our employees. So we had to manage through some fairly interesting times there. And all the things that the Victorian government has announced are all the things that were implemented overseas, and social distancing and panelling and all these sorts of things, all the proper PPE, which our industry does have a high degree of already for hygiene reasons, but now when we're talking about viruses and health reasons, that's taking things to another level.
And Darren, I'm presuming as well, given that experience over there, you've got a plan in place for your South Australian and New South Wales plants if the situation worsens?
Yeah, absolutely. We're already practicing, even though we have virtually no incidences in here in South Australia and particularly in regional New South Wales, but we have a plan. We also are adhering to the correct protocols and procedures with social distancing, whether it's through changes, shifts, lunchrooms, all the different things. So, and that's something that we have to be vigilant and we'll continue to improve on and continue to review those COVID-safe plans with the appropriate authorities.
Darren, thanks so much for your time today.
Not a problem at all. Thanks, Isabella.
That's Darren Thomas, the CEO of Thomas Foods International. It's coming up to 20 minutes to one. Up next, I'm going to be talking to you about this $10 million mission to keep food on our plates. It's all about making our food supply chains more resilient.
Mad as Hell returning this Wednesday.
Hey, McAuliffe, you watch your mouth.
And it's business as usual.
You get back to your own studio, Roland.
Speaking truth to power.
No.
In a funny voice.
Are you sure? Without fear.
No, I'm good.
Favour.
Oh, please, sir, please, times are tough.
Or an adequate budget.
All aboard!
Sean McAuliffe's Mad as Hell returns 8:30 Wednesday night on ABC TV and iView.
If it's the news you need, we have it covered here on ABC South Australia and Broken Hill.
Great to be with you this Tuesday lunchtime. Well, as we've been discussing COVID-19, but also bushfires, drought and the trade war with China, there's been massive disruption to our food supply chains this year. And that's why the federal government and business and research sectors have contributed to a $10 million program to strengthen the food supply chain and make it more resilient. I spoke to Dr. Mike Briers, who is the CEO of Food Agility, and he says more data needs to be shared along the supply chain between food producers, safety handlers, and the shipping industry.
Particularly in agriculture and food supply systems, there's been massive disruption, both to food security, there's been food safety issues, there have been businesses that have been really challenged by supply chains, in particular getting, for example, shifting from mass export and or bulk shipments to getting product onto shelves in supermarket to getting home deliveries and so on. So we've seen a massive shift in the way that food is moved around. For us here in Australia, we've had drought, we've had bushfires, as you've said. We've also got these trade wars, we've got some cybersecurity attacks happening, we've got also biosecurity risks and so on with swine fever, for example. And so really we've got a world which is becoming more uncertain. And what we know about data and digital is that it helps reduce uncertainty. So how can the digital revolution help us find better solutions to provide more timely information for people to make decisions on, but also to understand the changing context and to be able to adapt and mitigate for those events.
There's been so many things, like you've mentioned, that have been thrown at producers and the food industry. How have they gone in responding to those challenges?
Look, I think generally pretty good in the face of it. We're hearing from one of our partners who's in the crayfish industry, lobster industry, in your home territory in Adelaide there. The challenges of, for example, having to deal with a lot of boats, shipments going overseas. I think about 80% of their produce is exported. Their customers overnight started ringing and cancelling all their orders, and then having to deal with all these effectively ships on the ocean, with some with livestock in the boat, and having to deal with how do you redirect them. In some cases, I think we've dealt with it really well. In other cases, we've heard some real stories where a massive amount of angst, but also waste in some cases. Even little stories, for example, a mushroom provider who typically, and as we all know, when we go to a supermarket, we typically, when you go to get your mushies, often you just use your hand and you pick up the mushrooms and you typically put it in a brown paper bag, and we feel like we're being environmentally friendly because we're using a paper bag. But of course, what's happened is there's a big uptick in people wanting plastic wrapped goods. And so even having to change the way they're manufactured, the packaging on food and so on, has dramatically had to shift to deal with that.
And so you mentioned before this $10 million fund, and it's about bringing in the right technology companies and using data and being more proactive. And that all sounds really positive, but how can we use data to better understand and react to disruption and to make sure that we've got stronger supply chains to deal with the challenges that we're facing now, but, you know, not wanting to have anything worse happen, but also challenges that we could face in the future?
Yeah, well, a lot of the problems in supply chains and with data is that the physical product, you know, goes from farmer or producer to processor to retailer to wholesale, you know, wholesaler, retailer, consumer, and so on, and through that complex supply chain. And somewhere in amongst all that, there's somebody checking food safety. It's having to meet certain, you know, requirements and so on. And then there's also the logistics as well, the logistic companies that are shipping and moving and so on. And typically what we've identified is that in these supply chains is data isn't shared very well. So every entity that takes that product and moves it to the next spot effectively has certain data or certain information about the product, but that data typically doesn't flow to the next person or doesn't actually flow back. So, for example, in a meat, in a livestock sort of situation where the livestock lands at an abattoir, a meat processing unit, and then the animal is disassembled and turned into steaks and packaged and so on. But the farmer doesn't often get feedback about, for example, the quality of that meat. And so there's no feedback mechanism in the supply chain.
Is that sort of what you're saying, is that there's all this access to technology out there, but we need to take better advantage of it and share it more, and that's how we go about strengthening the supply chain when it is facing disruption?
Correct, yeah. And so we can anticipate, we can mitigate. You know, in an example that I'd love to tell the oyster story, in New South Wales, in fact, with the food safety regulator there, we've got a system that's in the water that is measuring things like ultraviolet UV, turbidity, salinity, barometric pressure. So effectively it's measuring the characteristics of the water that the oyster is sitting in. And what we found is that the more saline the water, the healthier the oyster. And so what would typically happening is the regulator would close that oyster farm if there was too much rain, because the rain would run off into the water, the bacterial count would go up, and so therefore they would close the farm. And so in this context, instead of basing it on rainfall, they're now basing it, their closures based on salinity levels. So that's faster. And it's also, what happens is the oyster grower effectively sees exactly the same information as the safety regulator, and they can mitigate. So in that information, where there's data, it's reliable, it's real time.
Just before I let you go, I just wanted to quickly touch on a comment here that you made in this release, saying that this is all about tackling one of the greatest challenges of our time, how to keep food on the table in a crisis and beyond. Is our food supply chain strong enough to endure COVID-19?
I think it is. I think it's just amazing as humans how adaptable we are. It's taken us a while, but clearly the COVID-19 is one thing. I think it's almost like the food supply system has sort of gone into a new normal, as we all have. But at the same time, it's not just about COVID. It's about, you know, we've all forgotten about the bushfires. And, you know, that was devastating for the, you know, the meat industry, for example. And so certainly what we're trying to do is with data is help growers and supply chain participants be better prepared for that next COVID, bushfire, flood, that next shock to, you know, foreign exchange, that next trade dispute. And so that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to say, okay, it's very, very obvious we're in an unprecedented context right now with the COVID, but it's more than COVID. It's actually preparing for the next one.
That's Dr. Mike Bryers, the CEO of Food Agility. What changes have you noticed at your local shop or cafe because of COVID-19? Send me a text on 0467 922 891. Mike mentioned there about the mushrooms in supermarkets and how there's greater demand now for them to be wrapped in plastic. What are some of the changes you've noticed while you've been out at the shops or eating at your local cafes? You can send me a text on 0467 922 891. It is 11 minutes to one, and while we discuss how to strengthen our food supply chains, we've also been talking about this disruption to Victoria's meat processing businesses. So is it time to rethink the industry's reliance on human labour? The director of the University of Queensland's Alliance for Agriculture and Food Innovation, Professor Robert Henry, says new technologies had been in various stages of planning prior to COVID-19, but food producers would now consider fast-tracking automation to prepare for the next pandemic.
I think we can consider that there would be quite a number of impacts of automation in agriculture and food production that really would help to make agriculture less susceptible to the impact of future pandemics. One of the issues, of course, is the availability of labour, particularly migrant labour, if they have to move internationally or across borders. Another issue is the problem of agricultural workers in processing and handling of food products. If they become ill, how do you manage the lack of availability of staff? And then there's the further issue of potential contamination, depending on the organism. COVID-19 doesn't seem to survive very long on food, but we have the risk with future pandemics that the organism might be one that's transmitted through the food itself. So all of that argues that we need to think much more seriously about mechanisation and automation of the food production system in ways that make it less susceptible to the adverse impacts of a pandemic.
Let's look at one industry that has been very much affected. That's the meatworks industry with abattoirs. What would automation mean? You've got large workforces there. Is it realistic to move to automation?
It certainly hasn't been thought of as being particularly realistic, but I think what the COVID situation is going to do is make us rethink all of these things. And really the problem there, of course, is you've got so many people close together in an enclosed space. And so I think what will be needed is efforts to think about how you could do that differently, how you could actually process those products with less people, certainly less people in close proximity. And so that might not mean just automation. It might mean redesign of those facilities to try and make them more viable for continued operation in future pandemics.
Do we have the technology to do that, just perhaps not the will?
Yes, I think that's the point, that the technology for automation of many processes, of course, is available if we're prepared to spend enough money. The amount of investment in innovation that would be required in some of these areas is not trivial, but I think the seriousness of the current situation will probably induce many people to think much more seriously about making that investment in developing these technologies and the applications of the technologies. It's not so much the technology itself, but applying it to these particular tasks. And I think that will be very much accelerated because of this pandemic.
Is there a huge change that needs to take place to take these from being quite novel technologies to being in widespread practice?
I think that's a very important point, that we not only need to have the innovation in developing the machinery, if you like, that might actually, for example, pick fruit, but you also need to think about how you might change the plants themselves, how we might select varieties that have an architecture that are more suitable for harvest, that in many other ways are compatible with the process. So what it really requires is a complete redesign of the system. And so I think that's where a lot of attention, for example, plant breeders is going to go in the future, is how to breed those crop varieties that will actually be most suited to this type of automation, because it is a combination, I think, of innovation in the plant and in the mechanisation that's required.
That's Professor Robert Henry from the University of Queensland speaking to Jody Gunders.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
It's 6 minutes to one. Let's step away from COVID-19 news now and talk about the drought, because we know that it's taken a toll on livestock, rural economies, and also endangered wildlife. Arid Recovery is a fenced nature reserve near Roxby Downs in the outback, and it's lost 95% of its endangered bittong population over the past 2 years because of drought. Arid Recovery General Manager Dr. Catherine Taft says the situation is dire, but recently they've received a grant to help them future-proof their conservation efforts.
In the last 2+ years, we've experienced some really extreme drought conditions, coupled with very hot summers, exceptionally hot summers, and we've seen a real decline in those populations of native animals that we're protecting, and we're doing everything we can to sustain them in the immediate term, and thinking about the future, how we can make that reserve a bit more resilient to a hotter and drier future.
How big a decline have you noticed?
Yeah, so for some species, for example, the burrowing bettong, they've fallen by over 95%, which is a pretty big number. But the species that's most at risk at the moment is the greater stick nest rat. We went from around 60 active nests with at least 2 animals in each of them a couple of years ago down to 4 at the moment.
Now, some people would say, well, you're near Roxby Downs. Of course, there's going to be hot and dry times out there. How unusual is the situation you're facing up there?
Yeah, I mean, it is strange. These are desert animals and they're, you know, exceptionally well adapted to living in really dry areas and surviving on very little with no free water. But these conditions are something else. So in the nearly 25 years that Arid Recovery has been going, we haven't had a rainfall deficit this extreme. So our annual average is about 130 millimetres a year. In 2018 and 2019 combined, we had a total of 90 millimetres. So it's really very dry. And that's been coupled with some really excessive heat in the summer. We've had a whole series of heat waves of 40 degrees plus for up to 11 days running. And that seems to affect the physiology of some of these animals. And we're trying to do some research on that to understand, you know, where how much they can tolerate and where the limits are.
You're in this situation where you have this drought and these animals are declining. So what are you doing? How are you adapting to that?
Yeah, so I mean, the first response is simply just to sustain the populations so that we don't lose them. And so we have sort of broken our protocol of many years and started to offer free water and food for some of the animals just to keep those populations going, even in small numbers. But then in the bigger picture, we're looking at particularly managing how the vegetation recovers from drought and reserving some areas as a sort of drought paddock. I know a lot of farmers have this sort of technique where they keep an area aside for the dry times so that there is some feed to sustain animals to prevent having to ship extras in. So we're looking at options to do that, to manage that for the herbivorous native animals. And also looking at these ideas of thermal refuges, so structures in the landscape, whether that's from vegetation or rocky structures or provision of a little bit of water, just to tip the animals over the edge into their level of tolerance when they're facing those really hot days to get them through those periods.
So structures, fencing, food and water, none of this is free though. So how is this going to be achieved financially?
Yes. So Arid Recovery gets by with some support from major partners like BHP and the South Australian Government, Bush Heritage, and also a few donations, but this is fairly costly on top of that. So we were really pleased recently to receive a grant from Landcare Australia and WIRES that were offering funding to support bushfire recovery and drought recovery for native animals.
So how much is that grant and how long is it going to last you?
Yeah, so it's $20,000, which will last the next 12 months, which should cover some of the costs for just sustaining the populations, but also give us the space and some resources to think about preparing drought paddocks and thermal refuges and start constructing them. So it will give us a good leg up, that's for sure.
That's Professor Robert Henry from the University of Queensland. That is actually the Arid Recovery General Manager, Dr. Catherine Tuft, and she was speaking to Lucas Forbes. Sonia Feldoff is on your radio after one. Good afternoon, Sonia.
Hello, Isabella. We're going to make sure you have all the information you need to know about the latest COVID cases and which places you need to know whether you visited today. Some interesting information coming out about that. Plus, if you, as we do our footy free tips today, photography is on the list. So if you would like to make your happy snaps a little bit better, we've got some tips for you from a professional photographer.
Excellent. I could do with a few tips myself. It's really hard when they're going so fast. So,
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, we've got better equipment on our phones than we used to have in our own cameras. This way you can get the best photos that you possibly can just by getting a few nice tips along the way.
Love it. Sonia Feldoff on your radio after 1 or after 1.30 across regional South Australia and Broken Hill. Don't forget, you can head to abc.net.au/rural for more stories from right across the country. Right now, though, enjoy the rest of your Tuesday afternoon. It's time to head off to the news. 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.